Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Not even summertime yet. It's already been a wild summer. That make any sense? Just got back from an amazing weekend at Imagine No Religion 7 in Toronto. I gave a speech called My Biggest Beef with Christianity for the Moment. And it's kind of a rant speech. It's just me venting to a room full of skeptics and secular people, many of them former Christians who share my frustrations. And so I just sort of vented, and I am producing that video, and it's going to release to YouTube and to podcast in, I think, 2 weeks, if not 3 weeks. So now, if you've ever been frustrated by the faith, your former faith, any faith, you'll probably find this speech cathartic. It is coming up in just a bit. It was a lot of fun to give in front of this particular audience as well, just a full house and a great time. Coming up on the podcast roster in the weeks ahead, you may want to weigh in on some of these. So I just want to give you a heads up as to what some of the subjects are. I'm doing a broadcast here in 2 weeks that's called Educational Neglect, When Superstition Shackles the Mind. We're going to talk about specific instances where religion and superstitious thinking, the culture of religious institutions, quote-unquote educational institutions, hamstring people, children and adults, and lock them into really bad ideas. And what are some of the bad teachings that are going out? It's a weird paradox because many Christian schools, my Christian school had a science class. And a science class. How much of that class was really about science? Not a whole lot. It was mostly about the Bible, and then they would try to tie it all into scientific-sounding stuff, you know. And so I graduated with all of this supposed science education. I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea what I was talking about. And I was just hamstrung. Many people are raised with really bad teachings about really important stuff, and many times they just never get out of that feedback loop. They never break free. We're going to talk about educational neglect. We're going to talk about whether or not it's child abuse to raise children to believe wrong things and to disbelieve right things. We're going to get into some of the specific teachings of various religious institutions, Christian, Islamic, and otherwise. And if you have anything to say on this, I'll give you the email address in just a second. Speaking of Islam, we're going to do a show called What is Radical Islam? We're going to delve back into the question, you know, what's a Muslim? What's a devout Muslim? What's an Islamist? What's a radical Islamist? Is there such thing as a moderate Islamist? Is Islam a religious movement or a political movement or both? What the hell are we up against here in the 21st century as radical Islam continues to dominate the headlines? We're going to talk to some people who have some inside knowledge from the Islamic faith and know a whole lot more about the Quran and Islam than I do. So I'm going to sort of contract out my weaknesses, going to ask a lot of questions. And we're going to do an exploration into Islam. If you want to be a part of that, the email address is podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Some fun stuff, too, on the horizon. I'm going to do a show called Seth Andrews Teaches Sunday School, a whole show on the Bible stories that pastors and Sunday school teachers in legitimate Christian churches just wish would go away. Like they really wish they weren't there. I'm going to do a whole show teaching those particular very inconvenient stories. Now, I'm really looking forward to that one. That's going to be a ball. What else are we doing? I've got a show about how churches prey on the disabled. And yes, that is a play on words. In fact, the title of the broadcast, which is going to air, I think, in July, is Praying, P-R-A-Y-I-N-G, Praying on the Disabled. They drag someone up in front of the congregation to lay hands on for a healing prayer. Nothing happens. What are the consequences of this? What sort of quote-unquote ministries do churches put together, targeted to the disabled? And what are the consequences of that? Are you someone who has a disability and the church sort of came after you? And what was that about? If you want to be a part of that broadcast, the email again, podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Let's see, what else is going on? Oh, I'm speaking in Arizona, June 17th and 18th. It's Flagstaff and Phoenix back-to-back. And then it looks like Denver has come together. I'm going to be speaking in Denver, Colorado on the weekend of July the 8th. TheThinkingAtheist.com/events has all of those details. Today's show is, it's kind of a short conversation. It's hard to get Dr. Lawrence Krauss for a long length of time. He's just being pawed at by everybody on all sides. He's got an extremely crazy busy schedule. I mean, in comparison, he makes me look like I'm just covered in cobwebs, you know, just blow the dust off of him because, I mean, I thought I was busy. This guy's always on a plane. He's always giving a speech. He's always involved in some sort of thing. And anyway, he was kind enough to give me about 30 minutes of his time to talk about his new book. It's called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. We're going to talk about the scientific explorations of life, the universe, and everything, as opposed to religious explanations for life, the universe, and everything. Krauss is always awesome. There's a video of that conversation, too, and that link to the YouTube video is in the description box of this broadcast, okay? So, going to be about a half an hour with Dr. Krauss. I'll kick it off in just a second. But first, I want to say a huge thank you out to our show sponsor. Dr. Stephen Gimbel has a doctorate in philosophy from Johns Hopkins University. He has a lecture series at the Great Courses Plus, which looks philosophically at how we approach a, quote, scientific worldview. Now, the course is pretty thick in terms of content, but Gimbel really does a great job of laying things out so that we non-scientists can really play along. We can learn and participate. The course is called Redefining Reality, The Intellectual Implications of Modern Science. And I'm sure the scientist versus philosopher debates are going to get some fuel out of this, but Gimbel talks a lot about how we as seekers of truth approach the data. How do we process things like relativity, the origins and the properties of the universe, the quantum, technology and how it affects our lives, cloning, artificial intelligence, and so much more. Redefining Reality is one of over 8,000 courses streaming right to your phone, your computer, your laptop, or television from the Great Courses Plus. And with my special URL, you can try them out, access the entire course library for free for a whole month. So let your education continue every day and support this broadcast when you sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Get started now. thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Lawrence Krauss is a theoretical physicist and he's an author of several books. You may see his face and hear his voice at several free thought events around the country and, in fact, around the world. And he has hot off the release of a new book called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Lawrence Krauss joins me here. Dr. Krauss, good to talk to you.
It's always good to talk to you, Seth.
Virtually. So you've sort of punctuated your book with some biblical language, which I just love. Genesis, Exodus, Revelation. You know, it adds a profundity to the work.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that's what it adds, but certainly it seems to aggravate some people, so I suppose it served its purpose.
Have you gotten some blowback already from people saying, how presumptuous? You know,
there was a review of my book in the scientific journal Nature, where the guy basically didn't talk about it. It amazed me. He was offended that I used the term Exodus, and somehow I could compare the 40-year-long search for the Higgs to the noble 40-year-long search in the desert. I was just amazed. I mean, it was amusing. And it was, the point is that this is the greatest story ever told so far, the real story of the universe. And for fun, it was nice to make biblical allusions and make section headings that it seemed appropriate to do Genesis, Exodus, Revelations. It was just a little bit of amusement and to focus on it, I found rather, people take it these things very seriously.
They're pedantic about it. Honestly, it's just, I think if Yahweh exists, he's probably chuckling along with you, right? I mean, no.
Yeah, well, one would hope so. This guy was a philosopher, so he takes everything seriously, I guess. That's the problem.
I'm not even going into the philosophy. I'm not going there.
Good. I don't want, yeah. In any case, the bottom line is, yeah, look, the Bible's got a lot of good quotes, and I thought, why not start each chapter with a biblical quote that was relevant to what I was talking about? Because I do want to make the connection between what was, I assume, for the time for people, the greatest story ever told, and their understanding of the world before they understood the world. And now we understand the world in a different way. And so I saw nothing wrong with making that comparison and pointing out that the so far part is the most important thing. The fact that our story changes, and that's a good thing. It doesn't remain the same. Every time we learn something new, the story gets better.
I'm reminded of Christopher Hitchens when he would speak about how, because religion was the first explanation for our origins in the universe, because it was our first, it was our worst. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's always, yeah. Every explanation that where we learn a little bit more is better than the one that precedes it. And today's explanation won't be as good as tomorrow's, because we'll know more tomorrow than we do today. That's the whole point. The fact that it changes, the fact that it's not immutable, is its greatest strength, because it means we learn.
Well, that brings me to my next question, and forgive my ignorance. I just saw a headline in a few paragraphs about the potential discovery of a new particle that might change what we think about the standard model. It was, you know, I just sort of did a drive-by of it. Are you familiar with the story? And
Is it one this week? Because there's been potential discoveries of new particles, you know, reported often over the last 2 years at the Large Hadron Collider, and they've gone away. And so I don't know about this week's story, but
I talk to people about the fact that, well, there may be some science may have to go back and revise some of what it has. And they give me that aha moment. Aha.
Well, you know, it's really important to point out revise. I mean, I talk about this in my book a lot. What satisfied the test of experiment will never be changed. Newton's laws work for baseballs and cannonballs, and whatever we learn about quantum gravity in the far future, they'll continue to be correct. So when we say revise, what we mean is that our fundamental understanding is revised, but in a way that is still consistent with what we know to be true. And by what I mean by that is what we know has survived the test of experiment. So the biggest misconception about science is that people think every scientific revolution throws out everything that went before, and then they figure, why bother learning science? Because, you know, tomorrow it'll be different than today, so it's always just a fad. That's not the case. Newton's laws are correct. Galileo was correct. You know, we've changed the laws of physics at the extremes of scale, and if we discover a new particle, it may mean that our fundamental understanding has changed, but not in a way that's going to invalidate the explanations of nature that already work.
So defend the title of the book. I mean, science, the greatest story, greater than the story of Yahweh, Jesus, Allah?
Oh, of course that. I mean, that's not even as interesting as the Odyssey or, you know, I mean, as I point out in the book. But it is the humanity's search and willingness to go where we didn't want to go and be dragged kicking and screaming by the process of science to understand the fundamental workings of nature is one of the most remarkable human intellectual journeys that we've ever taken. I would argue it's the greatest intellectual journey we've ever taken. And then based on those ideas, which were rather extreme and extraordinary, we built the most complicated machine ever built so far. And people spent 50 years of their lives trying to develop it.
There are those who argue that the Bible is actually even crappy literature. You know, it's not even really a compelling book, right?
The Bible is, most of the Bible is boring. There are parts of it that are lyrically beautiful. And I tried, and I liked, that's why I chose quotes from them. The lyric, as a piece of human writing, there are parts of it that are really interesting bits of literature. I mean, you know, the Psalms have beautiful poems and that sort of things. So, you know, like any book of that length, which, by the way, mostly has things stolen from the current era, as my friend Anthony Grayling wrote a modern version of the Bible called The Good Book, which stole, Without God, of course, which stole sort of literature and psalms and songs from the current time, that the Bible did just that as well. And somebody took the good and the bad. I mean, you know, the much of the Bible with this begat that, begat that, begat that, you know, it's kind of boring.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, which is intellectually more fascinating and certainly the real universe, which is the imagination of the universe is so much greater than the imagination of humans. And of course, the story of the real universe is more fascinating because we couldn't come up with this stuff. The human imagination couldn't come up with the Higgs field alone if it weren't sort of driven in that direction. Nature, that's why we have to keep our windows open, our eyes open, because the minute we sort of turn inward and try and discover things by revelation, we don't get anywhere. We discover things by letting the universe inform us, and we have new telescopes and machines. So every time we do a new experiment, we are surprised, and that's what makes it so wonderful. That surprising nature of reality is what makes the story so great.
Is that your response to those who say, there are people starving all over the world, we have all these resource challenges here on planet Earth, why build the most expensive machine ever created by man? Why fund these expeditions to the stars and the telescopes, etc.?
Well, look, there's an argument. If it was either or, I think it would be really an important question. It's not either or. Let's face it, the Large Hadron Collider cost $10 billion over 20 years, which is, you know, in total probably less than a week of the air conditioning bill in Iraq during the war. But so it's, you know, the sums of money we're talking about on a international scale are not extreme. Nevertheless, the public funds this, and the public should have a right to make decisions about funding. But we need to explain why we're doing what we do. But the bottom line is, the entire national budget of the National Science Foundation is maybe $3 or $4 billion, something in that range, which is just minuscule compared to the other things we spend money on. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be devoting our resources to improving the planet, to combating climate change, to feeding the world, to, in fact, educating women so that we don't overpopulate the world. These are vitally important questions in the 21st century, and we can't ignore them. But we, you know, instead, but the right way to do it is to try and do it through education and encouragement of entrepreneurship, not to build walls and to build weapons and to bomb things. That's not going to solve the problem. Take a cost of a major a modern airplane, it's probably the cost of the Large Hadron Collider. Anyway.
It's interesting that your book releases in kind of a culture where science is under attack. We're seeing sort of this dismissal, at least from, you know, an administration, a presidential administration, kind of a dismissal of science and scientists. And many of them are sort of worried not just about their jobs, but about the future of scientific progress here in the United States.
Yeah, I wrote a piece in I think December, the New Yorker, called Donald Trump's War on Science, and it seemed to be, I guess in retrospect, it's prescient. Well, it was pretty obvious that he surrounded himself with people who deny reality for the sake of ideology or greed. He himself doesn't really have any knowledge of any of it, so I don't think he can make informed decisions. And that's the real problem. A democracy works when we can make informed decisions about reality. That means when the voters have enough understanding of what the issues are and reality versus nonsense to decide who their legislator should be, and then when the legislators can base their public policy on empirical evidence. And that's part of the interesting, you know, the relevance of the greatest story ever told so far as well. I talk about very esoteric things in that book, the forefront of our modern understanding of nature. But what we've learned is that the universe we see is an illusion. And the reality we experience is an illusion, and we've been able to cut through that fabric hiding the real universe beneath it by using the techniques of science. Well, if we can do that to understand the universe, those same techniques of skeptical inquiry, empirical testing, constantly questioning yourself over and over again, those techniques can be used to strip through the illusion of reality in Washington. And we need to use the same techniques of science, the process of science, to separate the wheat from the chaff. Too often we teach science as if it's a set of facts. It's not. It's a process for deriving facts. And in that case, there are no alternative facts.
In the process of writing, researching, and writing the book, what were some of the biggest surprises for you or the things that excited you the most? I know it sounds a little bit like a sort of a trite reporter's question, but I'm really interested. You know, you do this all the time, but what it really rang your bell when you were putting this piece together?
Well, you know, I studied the history a lot. I thought always the case when I write a book, sometimes I think I know something, and then when I start to think about it more, I realize I don't. And particularly the history was fascinating for me to uncover. And what I guess I really hit home is the important thing to realize that, first of all, the secret that scientists are human. And by that, I mean that individual scientists can have you know, be pigheaded and prejudiced and biased. And you see that in the history of the dead ends. In the 1960s, the right answer to understanding two of the fundamental forces, nature, was sitting there in a way, but people were so fixated on this other direction that they didn't look at it for a long time. You want to shake them. And you can see how, once again, you know, the human aspect of science, people get fixated on often the wrong direction. But what's wonderful is you see how the science, the evidence, eventually forces people in the right direction. And so people often claim, you know, scientists are this or scientists are that. And indeed they are, but you can't judge science by scientists alone. The scientists are humans, and humans are not just rational beings. We're, you know, reason is a slave of passion for humans. And but what we see is the power of the data to eventually really take these people reluctantly in the right direction. And I guess I hadn't realized how powerfully all of the – there were so many clues to the right answer in the 1960s that weren't seen. And also it reinforced for me something which was one of the reasons I wrote the book, but I hadn't realized how appropriate it was perhaps. So that is, when people understand the history of science, they often think of the early decades of the 20th century from 1905 to 1925 as being – the most revolutionary period. We discovered special relativity, general relativity, quantum mechanics. But I would argue the period from sort of 1955 to 1975, which is largely unsung, is more revolutionary. We started that period understanding one of the four forces of nature. By 1975, we understood three of the four forces of nature exactly, and the fundamental mathematical symmetries that appear to guide all physical theories. It was an incredible period of development, and we understood that the universe we see, as I say, is this illusion, that the very things that make you and I up, the particles that make you and I up, their mass at a fundamental scale doesn't exist that way. We're only here because of this accident of this invisible field that froze in the early history of the universe, allowing us to exist. Once again, a universe that seems designed for us is not designed for us at all at a fundamental scale. It's, in fact, incompatible with our existence. It's only because this background field froze in the way it did if it had frozen in a different way, we wouldn't be here. The example I use in the book, and I often like to use, is ice crystals on a window. If you look at a window in the wintertime, you see ice crystals in all sorts of different directions. If your civilization lived on one of those crystals, then the spine of that crystal, that direction would seem special. The laws of physics would be different along that direction than other directions. Religions would develop, and they'd explain why God intended that direction to be special. And wars would be fought over whether that direction or that direction was special, all these things. And, of course, it's an accident, and an accident to existence. And we understand that now that many of the things about our universe that seem so special are a similar accident of our existence. The universe wasn't designed for us. We're lucky to be here, and we should enjoy it. But we're not the center of the universe.
I'm reminded of Douglas Adams. Was it Adams who had talked about the puddle inside the pothole? And it said, you know, hey, this seems perfectly designed for me. I fit in it just, you know, just perfectly. I must be its destiny kind of thing.
The example I have often used is, isn't it just amazing? It's unbelievable that your feet reach down exactly to the ground.
How much can we really know about the universe? I mean, considering the very small blip that we have and the very small sort of range of eyesight that we have as a species. I mean, how much can we really know?
Who knows? That's the great thing. We don't know how much we can know. People always say, well, science will never do this or science will never do that. And I say, what incredible conceit there is in that statement, because if you know what science will never do, you must know something that science doesn't know. So we haven't – maybe there are fundamental limits to what we can understand. There may be. We haven't hit them yet.
The only way
we can find out is by trying.
Do you think we'll ever be able to determine what caused the Big Bang, which is usually what happens when we talk about the singularity? They're like, oh, yeah, well, it happened. You have evidence. Great. You see the universe expanding. Great. What caused the Big Bang? Do you think we'll ever get to a point? I know you're theorizing, but what do you think?
Well, as I wrote in one of my books, my Universe from Nothing, the Big Bang may have had no cause. If time began at the Big Bang, then there was no before, and therefore there was no causality at that instant. So the whole classical notion of cause and effect may go out the window. Maybe that's not true. We don't know. But do I think we'll ever know? Maybe. I see no obstacle to, if we can get enough data, as long as we can continue to look and find signals from the early universe, like gravitational waves from the beginning of time, we'll learn more. Maybe we'll never know. Maybe we'll know.
My head just exploded, by the way. It may not have had a cause, just caused my head to explode.
Excellent.
Watching the last 20 minutes of Interstellar at this moment. I'm just not processing.
Yeah, but unlike the last 20 minutes of Interstellar, this one, this has meaning. But the point is that science, we don't know. And every day maybe we'll never learn everything, and that's fine. But every day we'll learn a little bit more than the day before. And not knowing what the limits are should not stop you. It's part of the reason. You know, the reason this is the greatest story ever told so far is kind of, as I think about it here on the West Coast in Oregon right now where I am, is that, you know, I think of Lewis and Clark. Not knowing if there's an end to the journey, not knowing where you're finally going is part of the adventure and part of what makes the adventure so exciting.
Walk me through the book. What are you trying to accomplish? Is this, you know, or is it a science book?
What I did, I think this book naturally follows on my last one, A Universe of Nothing, which explored the revolutionary developments that have taken place in our understanding of the largest things in the universe and how that impacts on one fundamental existential questions that humans have. Why is there something rather than nothing? This book follows on that by looking at how the revolutionary developments in our understanding of nature at its smallest scales, at its most fundamental scales, and how that impacts on another existential question. Why are we here? So what I wanted to do was change people's perspective on the question, why are we here, by understanding the remarkable set of phenomena and that result in our existence and that are largely unheralded, those revolutionary developments that we really haven't talked about much about in the last 50 years that have changed our perspective of our place in the universe. And in that sense, as I often say, my book and a science book and science in general is just like art, music, and literature. The best part about it is to change our perspective of our place in the universe. So this book, if it serves its purpose, when you read it, will change. When you finish it, you'll have a different perspective of where you are and where you come from and what the universe is all about. And if you have some fun in the process, all the more exciting.
Is this an exponential advancement? You know, our knowledge about the cosmos and our place in it? Are you seeing it just ramping up?
Science is certainly, if you look at the progress of science since 1900, we seem to have progressed far more in the last 100 years than we did in the 500 years before that and thousands of years before that. Because of technology, due to science, our tools to explore the universe are expanding all the time. And that's what determines the progress of science, not just thinking, but those tools that we use that give us new windows. And they're in every area, from biology to physics to every area, those tools are indeed exponentially increasing, I suppose. So, and that's part of the problem, because technology is advancing at a rapid rate and society is not necessarily able to cope easily institutionally with those developments. And how we handle that, especially when it comes later on to things like machine learning, will determine, I think, the quality of the future we have.
Forgive another, what some would consider a trite question, but I have to ask, do you think there's life elsewhere? Do you think, you know, certainly, I mean, right? I mean, there's got to be something somewhere, form of life.
With science, we say likely or unlikely. And look, there's 100 billion galaxies in the universe today. Each has 100 billion stars. We've discovered that pretty well every star we see has planets around it. We just discovered potentially habitable planets and around many of the nearest stars, and life began on Earth as soon as the laws of physics would have allowed it to, as far as we can see, within 500 million years of the formation of the Earth, when the bombardment by comets and other things had died down, life seemed to be here, and the fundamental ingredients are organic molecules and water and sunlight, and all of those are profuse in the universe. So it's hard to believe there isn't life elsewhere in the universe. I suspect there may be even other genesis of life in our solar system. Microbial life, perhaps in the oceans of Europa or Io, or Enceladus, probably I should say, which may be one of the more exciting places to look. Is there intelligent life? I suspect it's incredibly rare, but the great thing about a universe that's big and old is rare events happen all the time.
Is there a culture somewhere in another part of the universe that's looking up at the stars? You know, that's writing a book called The Greatest Story of This Side of the Universe So Far. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
one hopes so. We certainly, that's one of the questions that we all have. Are we alone in the universe? But, you know, and the amazing thing is we're living in a generation where we may answer that question. We are not only discovering planets around stars, which 25 years ago would have seemed impossible, but we're probably in the verge in the next 10 years of being able to image them and image atmospheres and look for oxygen. And so we're at the point where we may discover life elsewhere. As I say, I think it's a much longer shot to discover intelligent life, but I'd be amazed if it isn't out there and or hasn't been. Remember, the universe is 13 billion years old. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old. There is potentially time for many civilizations to have come and gone before us. Yeah, there's certain requirements before advanced life can form, like the elements, and that takes some time. But so, you know, we'll be gone too. I mean, people seem to think the universe is made for us and the future is always the same as the present. Our sun will end, you know, end its life in 5 billion years, and well before that, the Earth will become uninhabitable. Maybe we'll go out into the cosmos. Maybe we'll just disappear and be forgotten. That's okay. Enjoy a brief moment in the sun.
I can borrow again from Hitchens, where he said, who would forego observing the majesty of the universe to stare at the burning bush, right? I mean, why would you gaze away from the wonderful discoveries of science so that you can look at this ancient and primitive mythology?
Well, you think so. You think so. And some people are afraid that looking up will cause them to lose their faith in the value of what they see below. And they're afraid, therefore, to look up, and they don't allow their children to look up, which is child abuse. But everyone who sees a Hubble Space Telescope picture is in awe, no matter what their religion. It's only when they start to think, ooh, then maybe that'll force me to change some ideas, that they close their eyes. But the first time you see these magisterial pictures of the universe and what's out there, you can't help but be amazed.
You are one of, I think, the greatest science communicators on the planet right now. In fact, I'm listening to you narrate the audiobook of The Greatest Story Ever Told so far, and it's just fantastic stuff. I will include links to the book, both in audio and in paper form and digital form, in the description box of this broadcast. Lawrence Krauss, for your wonderful work and for the new book, thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the kind words, and it's always a pleasure to listen to you and talk to you.
That's the show today. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. Again, if you want to watch the video, it's linked in the description box of this podcast. I'm back next Tuesday. We're doing a whole show on educational neglect and the consequences of promoting bad ideas and celebrating ignorance. I'll see you back here next Tuesday for that. Have a wonderful week.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.